Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're here to talk about an issue on the Progressive Commentary Hour that rarely gets discussed, and that is the entire issue of mental disorders. Our program, the new DMS-5, the Diagnostic Manual for Mental Disorders, Creating New Diseases, Illnesses. Joining us today will be Dr. Gary Greenberg. Dr. Greenberg is a practicing psychotherapist, medical journalist, and author who has become nationally recognized for his expertise in the analyzing and debunking of modern psychiatric diagnostics, and in particular, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual diagnostic interest that he has is in challenging the prevailing view that these are legitimate and scientifically based. He also writes on the close relationship between science, business, and politics and the ethical problems therein. He's a major contributor to Mother Jones and an editor, contributing editor for Harper's. And his website is GaryGreenbergOnline.com. His most recent book, The Book of Woe, and we will get to that. He will be joined by Dr. Charles C.E. Gant. Dr. Gant has both a Ph.D. and an M.D. He's been practicing integrative functional medicine and more recently genomics for over 35 years. He is best known for his work in treating mental and substance use disorders. He received his medical degree from the University of Virginia Medical School and his Ph.D. in psychology from Columbia Pacific University. For two decades, Dr. Gant pioneered many nutritional, metabolic, and neurotransmitter and hormonal balancing and detoxification treatments. And website is cegant, that's GANT.com, and academyoffunctionalmedicine.com. Two important books he's written, ADD and ADHD, Complementary Medicine Solutions, and End Your Addiction Now. Nice to have you with us today. Hello, are you both there?
I'm here, yes. It's good to be here.
Good.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Sure can. Thank you.
Okay.
Here is the issue that we're going to be addressing. And I'm going to ask each of you to look into this in some depth. We have become a nation that seems that every single normal response to grief, to sadness, to excitement, to wanting time for ourselves, to being excessively joyful, extremely interested in our health, or not at all interested in our health, defying authority figures, aligning with issues that run against the mainstream, these are now mental conditions. We're told that there's a brain chemical imbalance, that it's been thoroughly reviewed, and that based upon good science, the good news is that your physician or your psychologist, psychiatrist, or neurologist can get you early detection. There's a major effort underway, sponsored by Hillary Clinton when she was in power, to test every kid. The idea is, isn't it a good idea if we test every single kid for mental health? And therefore, when they show any signs of suicidality or problems, we can get them into treatment. So, unfortunately, the mainstream media has accepted this as completely legitimate. Congress has accepted it. In fact, most of science and medicine has accepted it. Therefore, recently the Board of Trustees of the American Psychiatric Association gave their stamp of approval for the new fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DMS-5. That'll go into effect next week, next Wednesday. Now, late last year, when the changes were made public, a Dr. Alan Francis, a professor emeritus of psychiatry at Duke University, and the former chair of the task force of the previous DMS-4, wrote in Psychology Today that the American Psychiatric Association's approval of the DSM-5 was, quote, the saddest day of my career, end quote. Now, there's been a lot of criticism about the changes in the new editions. I would like to begin with you, Gary, and ask you to give a summary overview about the manual, what it does in providing and not providing an accurate look at mental conditions. For example, it does not recommend certain psychiatric drugs or treatments for specific disorders. How heavily is the manual relied upon by the mental health profession, and what groups within that profession rely upon it more than others? And who else utilizes it outside the clinical mental health profession? And finally, how reliable has it been in the past? What's his track record for accuracy in diagnosing mental conditions in patients? I would like you to start, Gary, but then I would like you, Charles, to follow up and give us your input on this beginning of this show, all right?
Sure. Okay, well, I'm bound to forget those questions as I try to answer them, so you'll have to remind me, but I'm sure you can do that. The DSM is really a dictionary, if you think of it as a set of definitions of mental disorders. And the way it works is that experts get together, mostly psychiatrists, and they determine what mental disorders are out there and how they should be recognized, largely by listing the criteria by which they should be known. And then they compile them into a book. They've been doing this for 60 years or so. This is the fifth major revision of the DSM, and it is a book that I think that the concerns over the DSM-5 are probably a little bit overstated, because it really is not substantially different from the DSM-4 or the DSM-3. The DSM-3 came along in 1980. The real damage was done in 1980 when the DSM-3 came out, and was intentionally an effort to capture as much of psychological suffering as possible under these disease labels, and to offer the criteria by which they should be known. And the reason for that was that the psychiatrists at the time wanted to move to a more descriptive psychiatry. They wanted to move to a more apparently objective psychiatry where they could agree on what disorder a given patient had, but they were stuck with a psychoanalytic framework. And in moving over to the new approach, they were worried that many psychiatrists' patients would no longer qualify for diagnoses. Every psychiatrist was worried that his patients would be excluded, and the reason that was important was because without a diagnosis, you can't get insurance payments. So the whole apparatus was erected, in some respects anyway, to make it possible for psychiatrists and other mental health clinicians, and I should add here that I'm a mental health clinician, it made it possible for us to continue to get paid. But the only way to do that was to include as many individual disorders as possible so that as many patients as possible would be covered by the DSM. How am I doing on your agenda there? Are there more?
You're hitting all the topics.
Okay. And are there more? Was there more in that original question that you asked me?
First of all, do you believe that the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which has no basis in science, there's no chemistry that I'm aware of anywhere in the literature that shows that a person can be diagnosed as having, let's say, bipolar based upon their brain chemistry. So why should we trust that some people who have their own agendas and their own biases, their opinion should be what represents an entire field of science?
Well, I think it's important to bear in mind. I'm eventually going to agree with the critique that's embedded in that question. But before I do that, I want to make sure that people bear in mind that many medical disorders do not have positive lab findings for them. There are lots of diagnoses out there outside psychiatry that are made entirely on clinical signs and symptoms. Migraine would be an example. And nobody disputes that migraine exists. Now, the problem with the DSM is, first of all, there are none. In fact, in all of psychiatry, there are none of these. And that means that it's very hard for psychiatrists to claim that they have the same kind of certainty about diagnoses that other specialties do. Now, that being said, the problem here is in the word science. We do expect science to mean lab findings, other measurable, objectively measurable results. But one thing that is true about the DSM is that once you accept the premise that these disorders exist, there's lots of science about them. There's lots of findings, there's lots of studies that have to do with the way people, you know, who have, let's say, major depressive disorder, how they fare, what happens to them, how they do on certain treatments, and so on. It's not scientific in the sense that none of the diseases, it's also scientific in the sense that the disorders can be agreed upon by psychiatrists with some reliability. They can take the same patient, and any two psychiatrists can agree that that patient has X disorder, with some, you know, better than chance. But what they don't have is validity. These disorders have not been found to exist in nature, and really they are just they are made up by committee. They are constructs that are made up by committees, not arbitrarily, but to some extent it's arbitrary because nobody really knows where one disorder picks up, leaves off, and another one picks up. And nobody really knows the definitive criteria for them. So it's not completely unscientific. It just doesn't have quite the certainty that we expect from our doctors. And it doesn't have the certainty that often psychiatry would like us to think it has.
I'd like you now, Charles, to give us your insight on the same questions, please.
Yeah, I'm sort of a big picture guy, so I could paint a historical picture that goes back a few thousand years. From the dictionary, we know that there are two distinct definitions of the word diagnosis. So there's one definition, which is to describe the appearance of something, and the second definition is to describe the actual cause for it. So for thousands of years, doctors treated pneumonia, say. They didn't know the cause, but it appeared to be pneumonia, cough, sputum production, fever, chills, and so forth. So they would make a diagnosis based on the appearance. And then the science advanced. Finally, we discovered germs. The germ theory, so-called theory, happened, and then we were actually able to treat pneumonia from a causal point of view. So that was relatively easy because there's just one cause, a germ, to causing pneumonia. When I diagnose my patients, I'll start with something like bipolar disorder or some DSM-5 label. I'm looking for 50 to 100 biochemical, toxicological, metabolic, genomic risk factors. The best way we have of describing it now, just like you describe heart disease in terms of risk factors, cholesterol, high blood pressure, hypertension, family history, smoking, and so forth, that there are, for mental disorders, dozens and dozens of known, and some are not relatively correlated yet because the science isn't in, but every single person with a diagnosis, you could take a 1,000 patients with bipolar disorder, the same diagnosis, it appears on the behaviors appear to be bipolar disorder, but every single patient will be completely different in their nutritional, their metabolic, their toxicological, their allergic, their immune. So typically I will gather 400 independent biochemical variables on every patient that comes to me with a chronic psychiatric disorder. And I'll look at the old pre-scientific labeling it. See, it's before there was science, before we knew the cause, we have to call it something. So all they're doing now is just calling it a label based on the appearance of how the symptoms look. But we're in a position now where we can get to the causal level and actually cure or correct these biochemical variables to the point where we're getting, you know, astonishing outcomes. And some of those variables, of course, will include post-traumatic stressors or early childhood psychological stressors, which we still need the psychotherapist to go after those stressors. But there are immune stressors, toxicological stressors, nutritional stressors, gastrointestinal stressors. There are all these stressors which drive the autonomic nervous system into a sympathetic fight-flight state, which we cannot maintain for too long before we start suffering these kinds of syndromes. And so we can get to the causal level. We can get to the scientific level. I'm at the scientific level, very, very much so. And so are the functional medicine and genomic doctors that do this kind of work. Most of us do the work in cancer and heart disease and the medical areas, but there are some of us now that are doing it in the psychiatric area.
Well, I see that as two issues you just covered. Let me explore one and then get your follow-up feedback. I have been working in the field of nutrition for a long time, and one of the first people I met was a Dr. Feingold. And Dr. Feingold found that there was an association between hyperactivity in children and coloring agents. And then a Dr. Marshall Mandel in Connecticut found that he could create depression in people who were sensitive to different, very dilute amounts of a particular agent. In fact, he actually did studies where he would take what looked like a little eyedropper and just place a few drops under the tongue of a person. And when they hit the right ingredient to cause a reaction, you could see the whole person's body change. In some cases, there was immediate flare-up of inflammation in the joints from just one or two drops. Then you had another person, you had a Dr. Alexander Schaus and Dr. Schoenberger, who found that convicts became far more violent, more disruptive, more likely to fight in incarcerated situations when they had dairy and sugar.
Right.
And in all cases, they were able to show by the removal of these offending agents, they could adjust or change or alter the person's biochemistry. And from that, many other people around the United States, including some environmental medical doctors, were able to shift people who had been suffering from hyper anxiety or depression into more normal and stable moods by detoxing, getting rid of the heavy metals and enzyme therapy and rebuilding the digestive system. So helping to rebalance the body's biochemistry is highly proven through very objective means. That is separate as an issue than having a person diagnosed as mentally disordered or mentally ill.
No, it's not separate. See, because they're using an older pre-scientific labeling. That diagnosis means you label something because it appears to be that thing. I don't know much about cars, but if my brakes don't work or, you know, if they squeak funny or something, I can label that as a squeaky brake don't work problem, say. But I have to take it to the expert, the mechanic, who then takes the brakes apart and finds the cause of why the brakes are malfunctioning. See, so it's very much connected. The problem is that the entire field of psychiatry virtually hasn't moved to the scientific level. They're in a pre-scientific, we'll take a guess, throw a drug at somebody, hopefully something works level, when we could be, applying all the technologies that we have to get to the causal level, but it's a lot more complicated than saying it's a food allergy. I mean, I do the tests for the food allergies, but it's a lot more complicated than saying it's just wheat or dairy. You really have to test for at least 100 foods, and then we go into the genomic level and we find the immunological genetic vulnerabilities to the food allergies. And science marches on. Like, they found out ultimately that these Feingold kids were just zinc deficient kids. ADD kids are deficient in zinc in the hair, the saliva, the skin, the urine, the sweat, the blood. Everywhere they look for zinc deficiency, they find zinc deficiencies in a high proportion of ADHD kids. And they were the ones, because zinc deficiencies screw up the immune system, they were the ones that go on then to react to the dyes and the food colors. Okay.
Alfred North Whitehead, a philosopher, once said, not ignorance, but ignorance of ignorance is the death of knowledge.
Oh, boy, that describes psychiatry right there.
and Will Rogers, the great populist, said everybody is ignorant only on different subjects. So when I look at how you and a whole field of what was originally called clinical ecologists, but have evolved, environmental experts and et cetera, by trying to take the symptoms and see what through the arsenal you have can be diagnosed, and through cause and effect, try to see if you can rebalance the person. Well, here is the difference I was referring to, and I don't think you understood my point, or I didn't make it clear enough. You can show a person with particular symptoms that so easily can be classified as a mental illness. Their approach there, the orthodox medical community, is going to have a very narrow range of how they're going to treat that person.
Right.
And their main concern is not getting them back to normal or healthy, but rather subverting the symptoms so that they're not obvious or manifesting in such a way. But then the side effects that the drugs they're using, the protocol
right.
they're using, frequently ends up, especially with post-traumatic stress disorder, with the highest right. level of suicides in military history. More people are dying each year from suicide who have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. But it wasn't the same way after Vietnam, which also had post-traumatic, because they weren't on as many drugs. Today, drugs are done early. Intervention in the theater of combat is early, and then we see these people crippled. So my one more final follow-up question before I go back to Gary is, and we'll get into some of the politics and conflicts interest later. However, I'd like to go through some of the more controversial changes found in the diagnostic new edition and get your feedback.
Well, can I say this one thing? The diagnosis that I use for a mood disorder, I use the DSM-4, you know, and I'd be interesting to see if it's in the DSM-5, is a mood disorder due to the general medical condition. And that's because I assume from the beginning there may be psychosocial or psychospiritual causes, but I assume from the beginning that 95% of the time, and I'm usually right, there is medical factors that are causing the person to exist in a stressed state, and it's my job to do the science and go find them and reverse them.
Okay.
So there is a label that is appropriate that I do use for because there is a medical condition always. It's always there. You just got to go find it. See?
I would share that there might be a life condition, not necessarily a medical condition, but a life condition or a psychosomatic condition or a spiritual condition can be misdiagnosis of medical condition. And then suddenly you bring someone into your realm of expertise, which is what psychiatry does. In any case,
right.
Here's my question. And this gets to the nub of a lot of this. There's a new disorder with a fancy name, disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, or DMDD, which is short for children having simple temper tantrums. Now, I'd like to hear from both of you your opinions about this one, because think of the children. I've never met a child. I don't know if there's ever been a child that at some point as a child they haven't lost their temper. Now that's being called a bipolar, and then they regulate it up to whether it's mild to severe tantrums, but this is in perfectly normal children. So, aside from the obvious, is there any possibility for a child to ever be a child without being diagnosed and pathologized and then commodified and commercialized, which is where all this is ultimately going? What do you think of the new diagnostic and statistical manual that also drops Asperger syndrome and absorbs it into autism? In fact, this is one of the first DMS that now officially includes autism spectrum disorder as a category. And I find this very curious, because autism is now at epidemic proportions, and 1 in 88, based upon the most recent reliable statistics from Harvard. There was a recent and extensive congressional subcommittee hearing, which I have all the minutes on, and part which can be viewed on YouTube. And there are three congressmen grilling representatives from the CDC and the FDA over their denial of any possible link between autism and vaccines. And and noting the dismal research to support their position and corruption behind it. And the official dogma now is that the vaccines in no way contribute to autism. However, the rates continue to increase annually. But some of these new categories in the manual are identifying symptoms common to autistic behavior. Hence, this new disruptive mood disorder is among them. And another new category being oppositional defiant disorder. It would almost seem as it is a way to steer statistics away from climbing autism rates and to shuffle them into other categories. Even Dr. Francis noted that the Asperger syndrome disorder is being introduced into the DSM in order to lower the rates of autism diagnosis, which could be about 40%. So would you please give us your view of pathologizing childhood temper tantrums into a new medical condition known as disruptive mood disorder?
You want to hear that from me?
I want to have Charles follow up, and then, Gary, we're going to go to you.
Well, I mean, I like the DSM-3 originally because they had a misery and unhappiness disorder, which is half the people I know, and they also had a elective mutism, which means where you decide to keep your mouth shut. You know, but they got so much criticism for that, they went on to these other labels. Look, I mean, you know, we diagnosed all kinds of pneumonia before we knew about germs. I mean, it's an effort in futility. If in the DSM-4, they say that these disorders are heterogeneous. They come right out and say it. Many causes. There are many, many, many causes. Biological, psychological, social, even spiritual. There are many, many causes. And we have to go looking for the actual root causes in order to cure. Otherwise, we're going to be involved in palliative treatment, just throwing drugs at people to numb them down, dumb them down to where the symptoms are numbed as anesthetics and hope for the best, because we're not looking for the causal level. We're not there. So, I mean, it's whether we label, you know, come up with new labels or use old ones, I mean, it's futility, and I'm sure there's lots of political and economic insurance for insurance coverage and all kinds of reasons why it's being done. But my concern is that psychiatry is not based on science. And until it is based on science, then psychiatrists are never going to be invited into the larger medical community as being purveyors of authentic science. They're simply going to be doing voodoo, throwing drugs at people, crossing their fingers and making sure that their malpractice payments are paid up, because they're going to be hurting a lot of people, and they're going to be incurring a lot of problems. So I don't care. You know, when you label this, label that, to me, that's not the problem. See, the problem is that they're just not using the new scientific definition of diagnosis, which is find the cause.
Right. Well, there was H. Somerset Maugham who said it is dangerous to let the public behind the scenes. They are easily disillusioned, and then they are angry with you, for it was the illusion they loved. So if we continue to accept that psychiatry is the purveyor of legitimate diagnosis and treatment, then it's an illusion that the rest of the medical community, irrespective of their standing of legitimacy, have control over, with enormous consequences. And my final thought before we go to you, Gary, in a second here is, why can't we at least consider that what they have done is just the reverse of what we're suggesting? You start off with people who have a vested interest in creating a market and then create the science or the pseudoscience to justify your diagnosing and treating, and therefore better understand the economic incentive behind all of this. Anyhow, Gary, I'd like for you to give us your feedback on this condition, and then I'd like you to address, if you would please, the disappearance of Asperger's syndrome from the DSM-5 and the manner in which autism spectrum disorder will be diagnosed, and why are we only seeing autism appear as a clinical condition now?
Okay, well, I have to say I'm a little taken aback by Dr. Gant's claim that he knows the causes of these disorders. You know, I'm no fan of psychiatry, and he's absolutely right that he's described it in a somewhat abrasive but I think correct fashion. However, I don't think anybody knows what the causes of much of the mental disorder that's out there.
That's ridiculous.
I don't necessarily want to engage with you about this, Dr. Gantz. I just want
to say,
there's
not a lead level that makes everybody depressed.
Dr.
Gantz, please. You were not interrupted.
If this conversation is going to be about Dr. Gantz's claims that he just made, then I'm not going to have it. If you want to have a conversation with me about whether or not, about the things that happen in the DSM, that's fine. But I'm not going to get roped in, and I'm not going to be associated.
Hold on, please. Dr. Gantz, I'm asking you to give the respect to our other panelists without interrupting him, as he and I both did with you. We are not claiming and will not claim that any of us, myself or you or Gary, are right on anything. We're merely presenting ideas, in which case we should have the right, without interruption, to share our ideas and respect each other in that moment. So, Gary, please share your ideas with us.
As for the disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, it's not quite fair to say that it's simply a kid who has temper tantrums. DMDD grows out of a problem that arose in the last 15 or 20 years, which was an increase in kids who had severe irritability, severe attention problems, distractibility, violence, early hypersexuality, and so on. That was the original problem. And those kids, for reasons that have entirely to do with the economic issues that you were describing before, in addition to the fact that doctors do want to help people, those kids got diagnosed by and large with bipolar disorder, even though they didn't meet the criteria for bipolar disorder, and they were then largely put on antipsychotic drugs. So there's a number of procedural, ethical, and scientific problems with having done that, but the upshot of it was that you had an awful lot of kids, a 40-fold increase in the number of kids on antipsychotic drugs, and they were going on at incredibly early ages on drugs that had never really been tested in a pediatric population. So the attempt by the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, was to find a way, another diagnostic home for these kids. And this is the way diagnosis works. It's a legislative process. It's not a scientific process. And actually, doctors will tell you that if you ask them. And it goes back to that mom quote. They don't necessarily want us to know this, but it's true, and they won't deny it if you ask them. They carved out those kids from the bipolar diagnosis. They tried to, you know, get them out of there. And rather than putting them into the oppositional defiant disorder category, which they, by the way, do fit into, and it's a diagnosis that's been in the DSM for quite a while, they created this diagnosis of disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. It satisfies the bean counters. It gives the kids a place to be. It will allow for insurance payments, but it's probably not going to change the fact that when you have a kid that's behaving that way, nobody's going to look at the large-scale social problems that are behind it. Nobody's going to look at whatever else might be going on there and changes that might be made in the environment to help that kid. And they are going to look at drug treatment, and it's very likely they'll still continue to get antipsychotic drugs. You asked before about the relationship between the DSM and treatment. There is none. People can get, doctors can prescribe drugs in any way that they see fit, as long as they can in some way justify it. And most, you know, 72% of the antidepressant prescriptions written out there are written without the benefit of a psychiatric diagnosis. So nobody knows what's going to happen with DMDD. As for Asperger's, I think the way you put it is more or less accurate. The diagnosis was too successful. Wasn't successful in the way the APA intended. It was successful because it created a community. It gave a lot of people a way to label their behavior, and people whose primary problem was being socially awkward suddenly had a community. And that was very effective, but it was too effective. Too many people wanted the diagnosis, and that had effects, both public relations kinds of effects on the APA. It made them look bad. And it also had, you know, effects, again, economic effects. The Asperger's is, like every psychiatric diagnosis, is the ticket to resources. and it allowed people to, it gives people, especially kids, some claim on educational resources. So I think there was, and all along there's been a question about whether Asperger's is really just a high-functioning form of autism, and I think that they decided to tighten things up a little bit by removing the label and by thinking that some of those kids will end up on the autistic spectrum, and some of those kids will end up without diagnoses. And I think that's pretty much what they're trying to achieve. I think what you see there, I don't think there's any grand conspiracies there. I think what you see there is just what happens. This is the problem with the DSM. It's a legislative process, and it results in a social handbook. It's not really a medical text, although certainly it's presented that way.
Okay. Now, those of us who engage in critiquing and challenging the official word of the government, even through our protests and demonstrations against injustices of authority, we can now be diagnosed with another new disorder called oppositional defiance disorder. Now, this has
A new diagnosis. That's an old diagnosis.
I know, but I'm saying it.
Oh, okay.
We can now be diagnosed with this. Mm-hmm. So how in the world can those of us, and there are many of us who are now protesting various social injustices, how can we possibly feel that this diagnostic and statistical manual is legitimate when legitimate social protest is now pathologized?
Well, I think that if the manual gets used that way, then it is clearly not legitimate, and I know there are instances in which it does, and there are more murky instances where people who are just difficult in certain ways, and that difficulty surfaces in social protest or whatever, who acquire psychiatric labels and are hurt by doing that. So all of those, including the things we've been saying today, all of those raise the question of the legitimacy of psychiatry. Psychiatry is a profession that's always had its legitimacy questioned, and it's never quite been able to prove that it is legitimate, that it belongs in real medicine. As Dr. Gant said before, they're not going to be accepted as real doctors until they get with the scientific program. The DSM has been their biggest effort to establish their credibility, to establish public confidence in psychiatry, by saying, you see, we do have a systematic way of recognizing mental disorders. Whether or not it's successful, I think, I don't think it's successful, but there's no question that its purpose is to try to legitimize psychiatry.
Oh, I would also add, it's completely impacted by the pharmaceutical industry that works behind the scenes, and we've seen examples of that. Let me give you one challenging question on this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm particularly interested in your response. We now have a new disorder called major depressive disorder, which includes normal grieving. For example, bereavement over the death of a loved one for over 2 months, and you can be diagnosed. Then there is a very ambiguous, open-ended condition called behavioral addictions that can just about turn any behavior into a mental illness. There's binge eating disorder for those who eat excessively on 12 occasions in a 3-month period. Well, let me think. I had a cruise once, and this was a health cruise on the QE2, about 2,500 people, and it had nothing to do with me. I was doing health lectures, but the ship loves to gorge people, and so people took advantage of it. They automatically, based on how much food that they would be eating and how often, could fall into this. So I'm very concerned that with all the so-called research and writing that's been done about the DMS over the years, could you give us an idea about what is going on in the minds of the doctors on the DMS task force, their potential conflicts of interest, their motivations? At least I realize the subject, but to the degree that you can speculate.
Well, I think that it would not be true to conclude that drug companies are paying doctors to plant diagnoses in the DSM.
What? You're kidding.
Let me go on.
I agree with that completely.
I don't think that's what's happening.
Will give you a lot of references and articles.
Let me finish.
Please continue.
Okay. I've actually been very closely researching this subject for 2 years, and I have the closest that I can tell you of an instance to what you're talking about is that one of the people on the DSM advisory committee who was in favor of removing the bereavement exclusion from the DSM's depression diagnosis, as you just described, did do a study years ago for GlaxoSmithKline on using Wellbutrin, an antidepressant, with people who were bereaved. Naturally, the study was successful because so many studies are. And that's a whole different, that's probably a topic for a different show. But the point is that he did that, and then he advised them that, and his advice was taken, that they should remove this bereavement exclusion. However, the problem here isn't so much these immediate financial conflicts of interest or corruption, financial corruption. The problem is intellectual conflict of interest. The problem is that the people who make the DSM are already predisposed to thinking about psychiatric disorder as the kind of thing that you treat with drugs, as Dr. Gant explained.
It's ideological is what it is.
Yes, it's an ideology that they share. Yeah. So, you know, those drug companies don't have to go to all the trouble of these conspiracies. All they have to the book is just it's like in basketball, you know, the book is it's like an alley-oop thrown to this pharmaceutical industry so they can slam dunk it. They don't need to go to all the trouble to make conspiracies because the book gives
I see.
Them whatever
so
they want.
I want to be clear on this. Are you saying there are no conspiracies that whatever we see? I'm challenging both of you gentlemen right now that I will provide you within the next 48 hours with a great deal of scientific evidence. The pharmaceutical industry has been controlling the research behind the drugs it does. There has been multiple falsification. There has been ghost written articles.
The clinicians are
influenced by this.
The physicians are not really, the physicians still generally, psychiatrists included, generally have an ethical context, and they're truly interested in healing their patients. They are compassionate, but the only problem is, in their toolbox, it's like they have a hammer and they want to build a whole house and all they have is a hammer. So they're going to drill holes with a hammer and they're going to saw boards with a hammer. They have one tool, which is pharmaceutical and, you know, compared to, you know, I've got a whole raft of tools that I can use for the appropriate kind of problem that's there.
Okay, then let me ask you this, Doc, again. If you have these tools, and no one's questioning that, and you've helped people, and we're certainly not questioning that, then why is it that you are in the tiny minority of all the physicians?
Actually, I'm not. I was standing room only last year in the San Diego Convention Hall. 27 countries were there at the yearly meeting of the Institute of Functional Medicine. So it'll be the same thing in Dallas in a few weeks.
There are over 900,000 physicians, and there's under 2,600 that we've been able to identify who practice what we would call integrative, holistic, or in some way complementary medicine. So you're talking about under 0.5%.
There's a lot to learn. There's a lot of biochemistry, a lot of genomics, a lot of toxicology.
But that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, is there a problem? You're saying that all these doctors out there are sincere and honest. And
in their heart of hearts, they're healers.
Well, I don't know that because I haven't interviewed 900,000 doctors. If you have, then you have one up on me.
I've never met one yet that isn't authentically interested in healing their patients, and I haven't met one.
Something to bear in mind here is that the game by which claims like these are substantiated or not is not exactly rigged, but it is a game that makes complementary medicine a much harder thing to prove because the game is rigged for molecules. The idea of, particularly when it comes to drugs, the idea of drug approval is that you have to have an indication, and you have to show that your drug is more effective for that indication than a placebo. That works pretty well with certain drugs, but there are certain treatments and there are certain disorders that are hard to define for the purpose of clinical trials. And there's certain drugs that can't, or treatments, I should say, that aren't going to show up well on clinical trials. And when you get into the area of complementary medicine, you have many claims like Dr. Gant's that simply can't be substantiated in the way that we expect these claims to be substantiated. And my guess is that that's partly the result of that may have something to do with the efficacy of the treatments, but it also has to do with the ideology and the methodology behind the way we approve treatments, and therefore the way we think about medical practice. So
when I published a controlled study on Medline, showing that if you take all the peer-reviewed studies out there and you just treat kids blindly according to those peer-reviewed studies. So there's like a dozen on B vitamins and ADHD. There's three or four on lead toxicity. So you detoxify them. There's thyroid disorders. So you handle that, give them some iodine. And you go right down the list of the peer-reviewed studies saying these are risk factors for ADHD. And you just blindly do it. We compare that to the Ritalin group. We get results that are just as good in carefully measured outcome studies using continuous performance testing. I use that as the pilot study, and I go to the NIH, and they say, okay, now we're going to do the next study, which means that we're going to actually test the kids first, and we're going to find out exactly what their risk factors are, but every kid is going to get a different treatment because they're biologically, toxicologically, genetically unique. And they didn't, it was like deer in the headlights. They couldn't understand what I was talking about. What do you mean you're going to do a controlled study and giving each person a different individualized treatment based on how they actually are? You got to compare something to placebo. It doesn't make any sense.
Okay, but let me interject here, gentlemen, because I don't want us to get off track here. My research and my years of experience in the field show me that I do not find the benevolence often, and to the contrary, I just finished interviewing for a major new film on this topic, a whole group of very highly successful drug detail persons, and their interface with the physician, the physician's office, and then looking at how much certain physicians are paid to use, like oncologists use certain chemotherapy agents, irrespective of whether or not they showed efficacy. And then the whole idea of placebos you mentioned. Try to find me a placebo study a real placebo study in vaccines. We looked at every single study out there and brought in a group of scientists. They were using other vaccines.
Right.
And then when they did use a placebo study in one major study, they found that a sugar pill was virtually the same for mild to moderate depression as was one of the leading drugs. Well, there's no downside of suicide when it comes to eating sugar that way in a sugar pill, but there sure is high suicidality as even one of the side effects. But the power that they had within stacking over 50% of the people on the FDA and the CDC's advisory panel with pro-drug people, pro-drug scientists, meant that of nine people who saw that they wanted to list it, they went reversed it and came out with the idea that there's not going to be suicidality placed on one of the major tranquilizers. Later, under a Freedom of Information Act, this came out. So I'm not confident that we are funding alternative therapy. I think that's a major reason that we're not seeing quality controlled studies. And I'll give you an example. Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, when he started to get good results, like Dr. Stanislaw Brzezinski started to get good results, then suddenly they find that they're attacked by oncologists, that their funding is adversely affected.
I was attacked by Elliot Spitzer.
And I've interviewed extensively two of the former heads of that committee who said that with funding, we have to beg. We get very little. So if you want to test whether or not an alternative or complementary approach works and you want to do it under some classical design, then fund it and test it. If you want to see does vaccine cause autism, why don't you get a group of kids that have never been vaccinated, one that have, and then test it? That's an easy one. They're not doing that. And behind the scenes, and this was just brought out at major congressional hearings under oath, and that's why I come back to that, time and again you see the people or the policymakers who decide what is going to be accepted at an official level and what's not, what's going to be paid for, through different Medicaid or Medicare and what is not. These people have frequently very close affiliations or are influenced by people within the pharmaceutical industry. Dr. Angel, the former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, has written about this as well.
The main motivation of physicians, I mean, if you understand them, I mean, we're the A students. We do exactly what the teachers tell us to do. We'll put up with any amount of abuse during our training. The psychology of a physician is not about greed, generally, and it's not about power and control like the government. It's about approval and being liked. We want to be liked, we want to be approved of, and we forsake some of that emotional development through the intellectual development, and we form all these committees and all these professional groups and pat each other on the back and give each other awards because we do not want to step out of line and risk the irrational cognitive dissonance of not being approved of and not being liked. So the physicians just are conformists, and they will never step out of line and actually take a stand that will disagree with their peers or with their professional groups. That's the problem with physicians.
Okay, I'd like your final comments. And, Gary, we're going to start with you. I would like to pose this for a short answer. What about arguing against psychiatric drugs, changing a person's behavior and personality, both better and worse, and the APA and the drug companies and the FDA and the Health and Human Services don't seem to care about the adverse personality changes elicited from these drugs? However, shouldn't we be looking today at a class of mental disorders that are directly related through causation to prescription psychiatric drugs?
Yeah, there's a very disturbing question out there about whether or not psychiatric drugs are, in some cases anyway, causing mental illness.
Absolutely.
The data are suggestive, but they're not conclusive. And there's, you know, for obvious reasons, there's not a whole lot of money out there looking to answer that question. But there's a disturbing possibility that, you know, Bob Whitaker in his book Anatomy of an Epidemic has outlined the case. It's a strong case, but it's not exactly a totally convincing case. But yeah, the question's worth looking at. The problem here is that psychiatric drugs were discovered by accident. There's still no real understanding of why they do what they do. There's really no understanding of what they do, especially when it comes to the antidepressants. We don't really know how to measure their effects. We just know that they cause certain changes on depression scales, but that doesn't really mean anything. So there's 50 years from now, this is going to look to people like lobotomies with an ice pick look to us.
So
there's no question that it, right now using an ice pick to perform a lobotomy would be considered some kind of crime. So I wouldn't be surprised to see it go that way, but I'm not prepared to say that I know that that's what's going on. I'm just saying it's enough to know that that might be going on to say, well, we really ought to slow down this whole train.
Okay, I appreciate that final comment. Dr. Gann, a short answer, please, because we're running out of time.
Yeah, psychiatric drugs are obsolete. When I did publish my studies on ADHD and made Ritalin obsolete in New York State, there was hell to pay, and I was attacked viciously because I threatened the whole industry. And so there is that punitive, totalitarian, ideological basis for punishing doctors that actually speak the truth. This conversation's happened 120 years ago with the germ theory. There were those that scoffed at, well, you doctors think that germs cause disease. Where do you get the basis for that? And those, the doctors that said, that studied it and looked at it and said, my God, we have formal evidence. We've Cox positives. We know these germs are causing a lot of these diseases. And to get the world to make that transition to a causal level is just going to take a lot of education, a lot of work, because you're breaking through an ideology. It's like breaking through slavery, you know, in the Deep South in 1840. You're trying to break through an ideology that people are so blinded with that you just don't know how to get to them.
I appreciate. By the way, I want to thank both of you, Dr. Gary Greenberg.
We're 95% in agreement on everything.
And you know, Dr. Charles Gant, thank you both very much for being on. I appreciate your input.
Appreciate being here tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
And it was Thomas Fuller who said, "Zeal without knowledge is fire without light." And boy, do we have a lot of, in the medical community, in the psychiatric community, we have a lot of effort, especially with this new diagnostic statistical manual, to make what otherwise would be a lot of normal behavior seem abnormal or a mental illness, and I'm very concerned about the underlying motives in that. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all very much for listening to this edition of the Progressive Commentary Hour, the discussion, the new DMS-5 Diagnostic Manual for Mental Disorders and Creating New Illnesses.